This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl and the first one in your feed for 2026. A big happy new year to you. Thank you so much for hanging out with us here on the Science with Dr. Carl podcast. And in the spirit of a new year, we wanted to kind of get into some of the life hacks, some of the habits that maybe you're trying to make or break as we head into this next phase. So we looked back at some of the questions from the year that was. Like, can we manifest our futures? How can you dry your clothes faster? Maybe you're wanting to change your laundry habits this year. And can you yourself help move a fart out of a room? Literally, can you breathe it in and help it move a little quicker out of that room? That was a question that we got last year. So we've packaged up some of these for you to take with you into 2026 that, hey, maybe you'll incorporate into your New Year's resolutions this year. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's get into it. We got Rowan in Eora, Sydney. Now, Rowan, I feel like you may be considering me with this question. Talk to us.
Good morning. Yeah, quite possibly. There's a lot of people. Obviously, we had the Arias last night, but I was wondering if there was any truth to the hair of the dog myth in relation to hangovers or any remedies.
There's one specific case, and it can lead to a bad outcome. And there's many causes of hangovers, and we don't have a good hangover cure yet. Basically, don't get drunk. So preventive. Now, in some cases, the hangover can be due to methanol. Now, there are many alcohols, and the one that the Bible tells you to take a little bit of for the good of your tummy is called the ethanol. We've been making it for at least 5,000 years in many cultures, in practically all cultures around the world. Pure ethanol is a bit of a toxin, but we've evolved a way to get rid of it. Methanol, the stuff that used to be in methylated spirits, that's the one that's really, really poisonous and can make you go blind. And there have been cases of people accidentally drinking lots of methanol. It's not in methylated spirits anymore, I don't think. So when you have an alcohol that naturally has a small amount of methanol, you'll hardly notice it. But if you're having a lot of alcohol, you will have a lot of the methanol. And then as your body will firstly start processing the ethanol, so it doesn't turn the methanol into something bad. As you're coming down off the drunkenness, if you're coming out of the hangover, as you're going into the hangover rather, your body will start processing the methanol and make you feel really bad. And then if you have some pure alcohol like vodka, your body will switch over from processing the methanol. The hangover symptoms will go away, and suddenly you feel not a bit of a hangover, but you're actually feeling a little bit happy from being a little bit drunk. So you've now trained yourself to realize, and this is real, that having a little bit of the hair of the dog when you have a drink that's high in methanol can actually make it go away. And the trouble is that that takes you down the pathway of drinking more and more, which is a bad thing.
Oh, yes, definitely. Okay. But so it just prolongs your body's digestion of the methanol.
Yeah. Well, what can happen is that the methanol in lower quantities will be taken out by the kidneys. So if you keep yourself drunk on, this is not a recommendation to keep yourself drunk, but if you keep yourself drunk on, say, pure vodka, then the methanol will, after a few days, be taken out by the kidneys, and you won't have that particular hangover, but you will have a hangover from the ethanol. And then just recently I found about something called the Mallinckrodt effect, where you feel drunker on the way up than on the way down. So you drink the alcohol, it goes into your gut and then it goes into your bloodstream, and then your liver tries to destroy it, but it gradually goes up 0.03, 0.04, 0.05, and imagine it goes up to, say, 0.06, which is above the legal limit, and then it goes up and then comes down again to 0.06. So it goes up to 0.07 and then down again to 0.06. At 0.06 on the way up, you feel drunker than you do at 0.06 on the way down. This is called the Mallinckrodt effect. But the other side of it is that you feel more sober on the way down. So you're at 0.06, you're still above the legal limit, and your driving is worse. Your driving is worse on the way down than on the way up, but you feel more sober. And that's, you know, a recipe for going out and having a car collision and doing bad things. And the way it was found out was that Dr. Edward Mallinckrodt, during the First World War, decided to test this on dogs. And he got them so drunk that on the way up, in some cases they couldn't walk, but at the same blood alcohol level on the way down, they'd be able to walk.
Goodness gracious. So basically just don't get drunk.
Oh, it's hard. Like, on one hand, alcohol, there is no safe dose of alcohol. And secondly, with regard to women, one glass a day will slightly increase the risk of breast cancer, two glasses significantly, and on average, 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer, 1 in 40 will die of it. But with the AI, we're getting ways of finding it earlier, like up to 5 years earlier. But then going back to the don't drink alcohol, it's a good social lubricant. Like one glass can relieve your shyness, and then you can come up to somebody you really like, you've been too shy to say anything to them, and you say, hello, and then you run away, and that's a real improvement. And so there's a social side as well as the toxin side. It's tricky, isn't it?
It is, yes, cultural aspect.
I reckon one glass every now and then is okay, knowing in mind that it is a toxin and it's bad for your health, but the social benefits are another thing. And there are societies that don't have alcohol at all.
That's right. Thank you, Dr. Carl.
Aaron in Castle Hill. Dr. Aaron, you're having a bit of a debate with your roommate. What's going on?
Hello. Yeah, another argument between flatmates. So summer is here. When it gets really hot outside, let's say 40 degrees, I would close all the glass windows and I would also close the shutters. We have shutters on the outside. But then to stop the hot air from coming into the house. But then my flatmate would leave the windows open with a little bit of a gap. They would tell me that because having a little bit of a gap would allow air circulation from the outside. But then I would say back to her, well, you're allowing the 40 degree hot air to come in. How should we deal with windows and shutters in summer?
Aaron, move out. No, I'm kidding. Dr. Carl?
This is actually a very high-level discussion, and I did a podcast on this, Shirtloads of Science, with Professor Ollie J in the early part of 2026. Ollie, O-L-L-E-J-A-Y. And it's complicated, and it deals with the fans themselves. So long as the air temperature inside is less than the air temperature outside, keep the windows shut, but keep a fan going to blow air on you. Now, the trouble with that is that you're slightly cooler, but your mate is absolutely correct. The air is getting stuffy. The carbon dioxide level is getting higher. I've got a carbon dioxide monitor at home. And you're both right. But then once you've achieved equality with the outside air temperature, just open the windows and just turn the fans on. The fans do not make the air cooler, but they blow over you and there's a very thin layer of sweat which it evaporates, thus cooling you down. So drink lots and lots of water. If things get really bad, put on a t-shirt and some tracky pants and get into the bath and then hop out and then walk around the house wet for the next hour.
But Aaron would be correct in that closing the window would keep the air cooler inside.
That's right.
While it would be stuffier, it would be cooler.
It would be cooler.
On the technicality.
Yeah, but after a day or so, depending on whether it stays hot during the night, you will end up with the inside temperature the same as the outside temperature. What kills people is when it doesn't cool down overnight. And we're now seeing in Pakistan and that part of the world heat domes where it doesn't cool down overnight. And on the second or third day, we have tens of thousands of people dying from the heat of global warming. But the good news is that we can fix it.
We can fix it.
We can fix it.
Hey, Aaron, are you able to play that back to your housemate on the Science with Dr. Carl podcast?
Yes, of course, because every episode is on the website as a podcast, right?
Yes, yep. Absolutely, Aaron.
And don't forget to go to Shirtloads of Science, and there's a 20-minute episode on the subtleties that we don't have time to deal with as we head towards the news.
Hell yeah. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
Hey, Tom in Canberra, you've got a question about farts, of course. What do you want to know?
I do. I'd like to know, can you sniff a fart away or are you better off holding your breath?
So talk us through this. So let's say you've done the fart in question and then you sniff it. Are you saying that you are getting rid of the evidence up your nose?
Yeah, basically. Can you sniff? If I and someone else are in a room together and I fart, can I sniff away all the bad smell before they get it?
It's like a self-vacuum.
Almost vacuum it away.
Almost certainly not, because you can breathe in about 5 litres of air per minute. The fart gas smells spreads rapidly through the room, the bad smells, and would probably cover in 20 litres in a very short period of time. 20 litres is like the volume of a human's chest, right? And so you couldn't sniff it all in. It's not impossible. You could do it. And the reason you don't notice your own fast as being bad is because of habituation. And there was somebody called La Petermaine in France in the 1800s who made an entire stage career of being able to speak to me chocolate lips, able to say words through farts, and even as well as lighting fart gas. Don't do lighting fart gas. You can get burns.
Okay, I'll stick to just sniffing then.
Yep, you've got to sit in the evidence, Tom. Lucas on the Sunshine Coast, what's your question?
Hey, my question is I tend to get, like, eaten alive by mosquitoes and midges, however my partner doesn't. I was just wondering, is that something to do with, like, my diet or the environment that I'm in, or what do you guys reckon?
Overwhelmingly is because you give off carbon dioxide. So when the insect scientists want to gather some mosquitoes, they go out into the field with some dry ice, which is very cold and it looks white, and you put it in a bucket. And as it warms up, it doesn't go into liquid, it just goes straight into the gas. And the gas is carbon dioxide, and the mosquitoes come from everywhere. So on one hand, because you as a male are on average heavier than a female, you'll give off more carbon dioxide. But the main factor is all these other chemicals which got really fancy names like butanediol, and there's all sorts of other names, which some people put out more of and some people don't. And the only way I can really see around it is either genetic engineering of that person or the old-fashioned put on the DEET, which seems to be relatively harmless. So if you're the one who gets attracted, who gets attacked by the mozzies, mate, it's just because you're putting out that chemical. It's just the luck of the genetic draw. Blame your parents. I'm sorry.
Emily in Kalgoorlie. Emily, what's your question for Carl?
Hi, big fan. I am just asking, what are your thoughts on quantum manifestation or just manifestation in general?
I haven't heard of quantum manifestation. Is that the latest use of the word quantum to try and get you to buy something or open up your wallet?
Yeah, I think so. They reckon it's a blend of science and spirituality that suggests we can shape our reality by aligning our thoughts, emotions and intentions with the quantum field.
Right. Okay. So firstly, in general, it can work really well, but avoid magical thinking. Use it as a motivational tool for yourself, not a substitute for effort and realism. In other words, don't just simply say, oh, I want to become fabulously wealthy, and then just continue doing whatever you're doing. It helps if you, enormously to have a plan. Hoping without action can really backfire. But if you've then got a goal, you can then work out a plan. And that's the whole, they take you through this. There's visualization and positive thinking and thinking that it is possible. Other people have done it. And by paying attention and being optimistic, you can pay, you can improve things. So the classic study was a magazine roughly the size of Vogue magazine, like an A4 page, and they deliberately, in this particular study, the psychologists, picked people whom they had found to be optimistic in thinking and pessimistic, and the ones who and they also said, look, by the way, there's a £5 note, this was done in England, stuck between the pages every now and then, go for it. And the pessimistic people said, oh, what's the point? And the optimistic people said, £5 note. And I think they end up getting £50, like they're there 10 times through. So just being optimistic, and sometimes irrational optimism helps, but magical thinking doesn't work. But definitely setting a goal and going down the pathway and saying, this is the way I want to go and have this happen, you've got a greater chance of success than if you just say, yeah, I want a car, now I'll just go for a swim instead.
Mm. Yeah.
And in general, avoid things that have got the word quantum in it. And I've got a really good physiotherapist, and unfortunately their practice have called themselves quantum something or other. It breaks my heart, but I'll still go there.
Still go. We've got Mitch in Yarram, Victoria here. Dr. Mitch, what's this theory you want to tell us about?
G'day, doctors. I've got a bit of a weird one for you. Mm-hmm. My mum has always told me that if you pee on your toes in the shower, it stops you getting gout. And I was just wondering if there was any truth to it or if it's just a weird wives' tale.
Mm-hmm. Hang on. This is the ABC. You mean the tale of a female domestic engineer or
absolutely. Yes, sorry. My mistake.
As a second job. Just setting you straight here, mate. Almost certainly not, but if it does work, go for it. I'm kind of, on one hand, the science is quite clear that gout is due to an abnormality of purine metabolism. Look up purine. It's a type of nucleotide. Look it up in Wikipedia. And it is what it is. And there are various treatments that we have. But if in your case, urinating on your toes while in the shower triggers a biochemical cascade, because humans are very different. If that happens to work for you, go for it. The chances are small, but on the other hand, the risk is minor, because all the water from the shower and the toilet end up in the same sewage system anyway. The risk is minor, and the benefit is large, but I wouldn't count on it. If it makes it go away, go for it. And if it works for you, that's wonderful. There was an old saying that they taught me in surgery, pointing out how different people are. Some people you couldn't kill with a lump of 4B2, and other people would drop dead from the shock of having a shave. So people are very different, right? And it might work. It might trigger something in your biochemical metabolism of purines.
All right, cool. Thanks, Dr. Carl.
Thanks, Mitch. Let's get into this one from Mitch in Eeyore, Sydney. Mitch, you got the aircon going. What's up?
That's right. I got a book signed from Dr. Carl recently, and I don't think I spoke a single word. I was so nervous.
Aww.
I was going to actually speak with Dr. Carl for the first time.
Oh, God, Mitch. And now here you are on national radio talking to him and the nation.
Thank you. I'd like to ask about aircon. So I'm trying to do my bit by the environment and turning it off when I'm comfortable, and then when I feel hot again, I turn it back on. But I've read online and people have told me that it's more efficient to run it constantly throughout the day. But it doesn't make sense to me, because it seems that the energy would be leaking in through the walls at the same rate regardless. And whether you turn it on when it's hot and there's a big spike in energy consumption, or if it's flattened out over the day, it would be the same or even less if I turned it off. So I'm wondering what Dr. Carl thinks.
I would tend to run it when you need it, cycling it on and off combined with insulation, which is probably not an option if you're stuck with renting, or if you're having a cost of living crisis. So at our place, we've got a heater, and we then put in 20 centimetres of insulation under the floor and in the walls and in the ceiling and double glazing. And before, the heater used to run continuously, and now it would only run for 10 minutes and it would keep the temperature nice, and our heating bill went down by a factor of 6 to 10. Now, unfortunately, you're stuck with the fact that in Australia, the housing standards are very low. You might have heard of the 5-star system for rating houses. It's actually a 10-star system. A 1-star house has the insulation properties of a tent. A 10-star house needs $20 a year for heating and cooling. The average for Australia is 1.8, right? So on one hand, you're stuck with the fact that you've got a poorly insulated house, but overall, you're better off letting it ripple through the day, be uncomfortable for a minute, and then switch it on again. So switch it on and switch it off and switch it on. However, you can die from overheating. So in 2003 in Europe, 100,000 people died from a heat wave, 80,000 in Paris alone, and they had to store the bodies in ice cream factories. Pakistan every year since 2015 has had a heat dome. Thousands die every year. We've got in New South Wales, in Victoria, when we had the big bushfires about 10 years ago, 137 people died from the actual flames, and about double that died from the heat wave. And the only way you noticed is, well, there's no signs on a body when it's dead, and they might be a bit frail, they might be a bit older, but the way they noticed was that all the morgues were full. So once again, the ice cream factories had to kick in to take the bodies. But the good news is that we can reverse all this, keep carbon in the ground. So in the short term, take care of yourself. Keep the aircon on. I know it's hard, and the grid hasn't kept up to date. We've been lazy on that. And if the worst comes to the worst, PSA coming up, head for a shopping centre, a library, or even a movie, and don't die. Because we still haven't had the peak heat waves come through.
Cool. I'll keep those blinds closed and just do what I'm doing then.
Keep the blinds closed. And also, I did a story about fans. It's coming up on Shirtloads of Science. It turns out that I wrongly thought that no matter what, if you had a fan blowing, it would actually be good for you. But if the air temperature is above 40 degrees C, turning a fan on will put you into cardiac distress. And there was somebody with the name of Ollie Jay at the University of Sydney, who is a specialist in thermal physiology, and they had to cut the experiments short because they were running the risk of killing their subjects. So I always thought, so a fan below 40, probably good for you. Above 40, probably bad for you.
Oh, my gosh.
There's subtleties to this. Just keep fossil carbon in the ground.
We've got Matt from Jindawi on the line. Oh, Matt, this is Dr. Carl's favourite topic. What do you want to know?
Well, how are you going? I was just wondering about hanging clothes on the line outside.
Oh, wonderful my language, brand. Brother.
Loving
yep.
it.
Yep.
And I was thinking, I'm a bit of a thinker, so I'm like, is this drying faster in the wind when it's spinning, or should I make it not spin?
Ah, so the way to understand what's going on is to follow the advice of Richard Feynman and remember that everything is made of atoms. So in this case, you've got three atoms together, two hydrogens and one oxygen. We call that H2O.
Roger.
Now, the water molecules in the wet clothes will jump off the clothes and then jump back again. And on average, because there's a concentration gradient, they'll tend to move away from the clothes. If you've got a wind, either on a stationary clothesline or you're making an artificial wind by spinning it, then you tend to leave those water molecules behind and the clothes move on, so it will dry faster. However, you can also dry your clothes by hanging them indoors. And I was reading in the latest Choice magazine, you know you're not supposed to put Lycra stuff through a dryer?
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. I know it's hard because life has to go on. And in some parts of the world, they do not have access to a clothesline, so everything goes in a dryer. But in the latest Choice magazine, there's a whole list of things which I was thinking of being obsessive and photocopying and then sealing it in plastic and then putting it near the dryer to warm people, not to put it through the dryer. But then if it's raining, you put it through anyway, so who cares?
Mm.
So, yes, to answer your question, if there's a bit of a wind, things will dry faster.
Well, there you go. Because I was thinking with that wind, if it's going with the wind, you know, how is it drying faster if it was sort of going with the wind, you know?
You're getting a bit of centrifugal force as the clothesline rotates.
Yes.
I've got one of those just lines up the side of the house. It doesn't even get sun. I miss having a Hills hoist.
But it will still work indoors or outdoors. Yeah. You just have to add enough time. And when it rains for days at a time, you just have the whole house cluttered. And if you don't have a big enough apartment, bummer, boo the patriarchy or something.
And we've got Gavin in Mianjin. Gavin, a few people getting sick. I feel like I'm getting a little bit of a throat moment. What do you want to know?
Well, see, I'm on the similar lines of like drinking lemonade, flat lemonade when you're sick. An old wives' tale that I've heard is that just when you start to feel better, well, you're having like a cold or flu, that night just pour yourself like a stiff drink or two and that it will help kill the last of the bacteria. Is there any truth to that, please?
No. On one hand, physiologically, there are no physiological benefits from having alcohol ever, and it's a bit of a poison. But on the other hand, there's the psychological benefits of relaxing you a bit in an awkward situation. Just a little bit can help. And then on the other hand, we do have the Christian Bible says, drink a little alcohol for the good of thy belly. And so following that, I've kind of given the kids a little bit of Benedictine or some such high-octane sweet alcohol whenever they're a bit crook all their lives. And I don't think it hurt and it made him feel better. But I definitely do not think that alcohol, from what I've read, in any way improves the situation with regard to the bacteria and the infectious agent. But just a little tiny touch makes you feel like, oh, I deserve to get better. But just only a little bit.
Or maybe it makes you more sleepy so then you can sleep easier.
True. But on the other hand, alcohol will make you sleep more readily, but the quality of the sleep is not as good. So you have to get into that situation where you just have a small amount of alcohol and you sip it slowly and with each one you think, oh, this is fantastic, as opposed to, I've just had 2 gallons. That's terrific. I'll feel better. No, just go for a small amount and enjoy it massively.
All right. Sounds good to me.
Thanks, Gavin. And that's it. Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. Please let me know if you end up implementing any of these life hacks. If you end up taking any of these into 2026, leave a comment on YouTube or a review on Apple Podcasts. And next week, we have a very special episode for you. Hottest 100 voting is open, and we've looked into some of the biggest songs of 2025 to kind of fact check the science behind them. Dr. Carl is going to be getting into those next week. And also mark your calendar, because in the new year, Thursday, January 15, Science with Dr. Carl will be back for 2026. So if you want to submit a question for our debut episode in the new year, make sure you're ready to go. We do it every Thursday, 11 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, and start taking questions from about 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time on 0439 757 555. I'm Lucy Smith. I hope you're having an excellent holiday season. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.